This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a singer I suspect you haven't heard that I'd like to introduce you to. Her name is Catherine Russell. On her new CD, Sentimental Streak, she does songs associated with Bessie Smith, Frank Sinatra, Hoagy Carmichael, Lena Horne, and her late father, Louis Russell. He was a pianist, composer, and arranger who served as Louis Armstrong's music director during much of the 1930s and in the early 1940s, and also led his own band. Catherine Russell is now in her early 50s and spent much of her career as a backup singer for such performers as Paul Simon, David Bowie, Cyndi Lauper, and the band Steely Dan. Sentimental Streak is the second CD she's made under her own name. Let's start with the opening track, So Little Time, So Much to Do, a song first recorded by Armstrong with an arrangement by Catherine's father. That arrangement is recreated in this new recording.
So little time, so much to do. There's so little time for dreams to come true. Many a ship to sail, many a magic land, many a moonlit trail, many a road to walk hand in hand. There are songs of love we never have sung. Let's not waste a night. So little time, so much to do.
That's Catherine Russell from her new CD, which is called Sentimental Streak. Catherine Russell, welcome to Fresh Air. And I just want to say, where have you been? How can you have been a backup singer for so long and only have like two recent albums under your own name?
You know, I started years ago. I just really wanted to have a career in the music business, and I just didn't, you know how to start. So I started with whatever blues I knew and sat in wherever I could in clubs around New York City. And that kind of turned into a career in backup singing and touring. So that basically for a number of years left me with no time to think about having a solo career.
The song that we opened with was once recorded by Louis Armstrong and arranged by your father, Louis Russell. I know your father died when you were seven, so you didn't you didn't know him as you matured. But did you grow up with a lot of early jazz recordings? Because you certainly have a feel for early jazz on your own recordings.
Well, his recordings were some of the first recordings I remember hearing in my life, you know. So that element of swing and fun was some of the earliest music that I absorbed, you know, and I thought, wow, that sounds like fun. And New Call of the Freaks, one of his hits, you know, for Louis Russell Orchestra, was one of the first things I remember hearing. And I thought, that's funny. And every time I heard it, I would laugh, you know. So I just love the swing of music and when people went out to socialize and dance to swing music. So that's really why I'm drawn to that period of jazz.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Call of the Freaks because that's one of your father's better known tunes.
Yes.
And your father did two songs that, that are similar. There's Call of the Freaks and then there's New Call of the Freaks.
Right.
Let's
right.
play one of them. Which would you like us to play?
I would say New Call of the Freaks because that one has the vocal trio arrangement and the lyrics, take out the can, here comes the garbage man, which I thought was so funny when I was a kid.
Okay, so this is Louis Russell, Catherine Russell's father, and his band.
Garbage man,
That's New Call of the Freaks, featuring my guest Catherine Russell's father, Louis Russell, who had his own band in the 20s and 30s and then became music director for Louis Armstrong. And Catherine Russell, my guest, is a terrific singer with a new CD called Sentimental Streak. And while we're giving a shout-out to your father and his musical influence on you, we should also mention that your mother, Carlene Ray, is a musician and singer. Is it guitar or bass or both?
Well, it's both, actually. She was a member of the International Sweethearts of Rhythm in the mid-40s during the Second World War, when a lot of female musicians came to the forefront as a result of the men, you know, going to war. So a lot of female musicians emerged at that time, and she joined the Sweethearts, I think, right after she graduated from Juilliard School of Music in 1946, and she was the band guitarist and then featured vocalist at some points.
And the International Sweethearts of Rhythm was an all-women's band.
All-female orchestra, yes, all-female jazz orchestra.
And just another question about your mother.
Yes.
Did she tell you interesting things about what it was like in the 40s to be a female jazz musician?
Yeah, there were a lot of stories, you know, which formed who she is. And just, you know, she was playing guitar in the 40s and then switched to bass mainly in the 50s. And you know how people would just laugh when she'd walk in, you know, saying, "Oh, little girl, you know, what are you doing with that big instrument," you know, type of thing. And, you know, people really did not take women seriously, and particularly, you know, African-American women. And, you know, she would tell me stories about how there was one night where, you know, the black and white started to mix. They were playing some kind of a dance function, and they created a bomb scare because they didn't want the races to be mixing on the dance floor. They'd have ropes down the middle of the dance floor so that black and white couldn't mix, you know, all kinds of different things like that. So, you know, I really feel that the women that came up in that period of jazz were strong beyond our imagination. They really were.
So, you know, you sing a lot of jazz and blues. We talked about the influence of your father, Louis Russell, who started leading his band in the 1920s. What was the music of your contemporaries, your friends, when you were growing up?
Mostly, I'd say the first, you know, I started collecting 45 recordings when I was, 7 or 8 years old. So the first 45, I think I bought was by the Supremes, and I was really into Motown because that's what was, you know, playing on popular radio at that time, and then later on rock and roll, you know, all of the Jefferson Airplane, Grateful Dead, Led Zeppelin, you know, variety of classic rock, and then actually soul music, so Sam Cooke, Otis Redding, Joe Tex, all of those artists.
Now, you had said that one of your influences when you were coming of age was soul music and Sam Cooke. So I thought we'd go to your first CD and listen to you doing a Sam Cooke song.
Okay, excellent.
And we're going to hear Put Me Down Easy.
Yes.
From your first CD, which is called Cat, which is short for Catherine, and my guest is
yes.
Catherine Russell. You want to say anything about this selection before we hear it?
Sam Cooke also produced so many artists, and those productions, those tunes are great too, you know, the ones that he's not singing. So this is one sung by his brother, L.C. Cooke, and it just struck me when I heard it, and I said, I just have to sing this song.
Okay, and here's Catherine Russell from her first CD, which is called Cat.
Just put
That's Catherine Russell from her first CD, Cat, singing a song written by Sam Cooke. Her new CD, which is her second, is called Sentimental Streak. Let's talk a little bit more about how what life was like for you as a backup singer. I mean, among the people who you sang with were Al Green, David Bowie, Isaac Hayes, yes?
Yes, yes. Al Green and Isaac Hayes were TV shows, so I've also gotten to do a lot of shows with late night shows with those artists. So I got to sing with Al Green twice.
Tell me something about singing with Al Green.
I was in a section of three women, and we sang "I'm Still in Love with You."
And what was the part like? What's the part that you were doing?
Let's see. Who? You know, some oohs and ahs, and don't you know I'm still in, sure enough in love with you, you know. And so the three of us were harmonizing behind him, and, you know, in the clip that I taped from the show, I'm just grinning from ear to ear. I'm just so happy, and I'm laughing, you know. And so, you know, you just see me on camera laughing, basically, between phrases.
Okay, let's try another. Touring with David Bowie, what did you have to do?
Well, I got that gig because David was looking for someone that could sing backup parts, you know, backup vocals, and play keyboard parts, which I can do. I did that with Cyndi Lauper. And so it turned out, though, that David let me do everything that I can do, which is play mandolin. I played guitars. I played percussion. And I was really integrated. It's a real band situation with him. So, you know, he's a member of the band. He just happens to be the front person who wrote all these amazing songs, you know. But it's a very integrated situation. So it was a fabulously busy gig for me. So on every song, I was doing something else. String arrangements, you know, that I had learned. And it was just the most incredible musical experience for me, you know, to be singing Ziggy Stardust with him and playing, you know, power chords on an electric guitar. That was fantastic.
What were your lines?
Well, it was kind of, so where were the spiders while the fly tried to, you know. And so it's all of those parts of the song. And also, come on, come on, we really got a good thing going. Come on, come on, if you want it, then you better get on to yourself, you know. And that was another song from the rise and fall of Ziggy Stardust that I just love.
So what do you do on stage when you're a backup singer during the parts when you're not singing?
Well, if I'm not playing an instrument, I'm either in a section with other women moving together, so we make sure that, you know, we're moving right and then we're moving left so the section looks coordinated. And if I'm playing an instrument, I'm just doing that and being animated. You know, you
right.
Can't really, yeah, you have to be animated. You can't really, you know, stand still and look bored and all that type of thing. You really must reflect that you're happy to be there, you know. So, you know, which is, I think, something that horn players could do more of.
Instead of walking out and having a smoke while somebody else solos or something.
Instead of waiting, yes. Yeah. It would be, you know, nice to see some animation. But that's my personal opinion.
One of the things you did, this is before you started recording under your own name, is that You sang between acts at the comedy club Catch a Rising Star. That strikes me
yes.
Like it might have been a real thankless job. How was it?
You know, it was my first kind of real steady gig in New York. And the drummer at that point, they had a trio there who used to play the comics on and off. And the drummer called me up because I had been doing a few other gigs with him. And he said, you know, why don't you come by? You know, maybe I think they would like you here. Come by and sing some blues, you know. So I was scared to death, went the first night, and was there for 4 years. And actually, it was a great gig. And, you know, it really toughens up your character because they put me in the spot, which was called the check spot, which meant that that was the spot in the evening where they would be handing out the checks. So I could sing louder than the people haggling over what they were going to leave their waitstaff and so forth, you know. And they would also put me on after big names, like if they had Eddie Murphy or Robin Williams or somebody else come in of note, Jerry Seinfeld, all these people, Rodney Dangerfield, all these people would come in there and try out their new acts and so forth. And so they'd always put the singer on after the stars because other comedians, of course, didn't want to follow those people. So it was really good, you know. It was a good training. I did it six nights a week for 4 years.
But to sum up, you got the two worst spots. The spot when the waiters were handing out the checks. And after an act that was too tough for anyone else to follow. So, and was this also the sexist comic era?
No, it was, you know, it's interesting. I'm not sure about that because, you know, also people like Joy Behar, Susie Essman. So they were there and they were emceeing just as much as, you know, everybody was really there every night. So we were all hanging out together, mm-hmm, you know. Mm-hmm. So I didn't feel that.
Well, I want to play another song that you do on your new CD that was written by your father, Louis Russell.
Yes.
And this is I've Got That Thing. It's really delightful. Say something about why you chose this song.
I was looking through one of his early compilations, and I think it was the 1929 to 1930 compilation of Louis Russell Orchestra. And I came upon this, and it was kind of another call of the freak situation where I thought, this is funny, this is hilarious, you know. And the track was funny, and I started laughing immediately. And I thought, wow, let's recreate this and have, you know, Howard Johnson, you know, come in on some tuba. And it just turned out so great because Stephen, you know, came in and played like this Dixieland, you know, made this Dixieland arrangement of it. So,
and this is Stephen Bernstein who did the arrangements on.
Yes, yes.
On so this is Catherine Russell from her new CD, Sentimental Streak, a song written by her father called I've Got That Thing.
I don't care if the sun don't shine because I've got that thing.
Catherine Russell from her new CD, Sentimental Streak, and her father, Louis Russell, co-wrote the song we just heard. You taught voice for a few years. Was there any particular piece of advice you would give your students that really came from your experience that you think, like, not all teachers would impart?
The way I teach, I mean, I really stress enjoyment of, you know, performance. Also, picking material that you can express yourself through. Don't pick something that, you know, just because we love Aretha Franklin, we all love Aretha Franklin, you know, but maybe that's not the person that you should be picking. You know what I'm saying? So I love Chaka Khan as a vocalist. She's fabulous, but this is not my particular style. So I would say it's very difficult for singers to find their own style. So you really need to find songs that you can express yourself through, you know, more so than hearing another artist and saying, oh, I want to sound like them.
Catherine Russell, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much, Terry. I appreciate it.
Catherine Russell's new CD is called Sentimental Streak. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Although he became a famous and influential poet after his death, the British writer and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins was never published in his lifetime. He died in 1889 at the age of 44. For several years, he renounced poetry because he believed it was in conflict with the life of a priest. His silence as a poet was broken after he read about a shipwreck in December 1875 that killed five German nuns. It inspired his famous poem, The Wreck of the Deutschland. My guest Ron Hansen has written a new historical novel based on the life of Gerard Manley Hopkins called Exiles. One of the novels Hansen is best known for, Mariette in Ecstasy, is about a young nun in the early 1900s. Hansen is Catholic and recently became a deacon. He teaches at Santa Clara University. He's also the author of The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a movie that played last year and starred Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck. Ron Hansen, welcome to Fresh Air. Well, I'd like to have you read a short excerpt of your novel, Exiles. Would you like to just set it up for us?
Yes, this is early in Hopkins' career when he was a Jesuit and he was not yet a priest. He was studying theology in Wales, and he came across this account of a shipwreck, the Deutschland, off the east coast of England. And he woke up with the sound of the wreck of the Hesperus sounding in his ears, and he realized that's not the kind of poetry he wanted to write, even though Longfellow's famous poem was widely known throughout the world. But after he woke up, I get into something of Hopkins' background. The scruples to which he was prey caused Hopkins to consider the worldly pursuit of poetry writing in conflict with his vocation to the priesthood. Just before entering the Society of Jesus in 1868, Hopkins resolved to pen no more verse unless his religious superiors requested it. And in a theatrical act of renunciation, he incinerated some copies of his Oxford poems in a secret ceremony that he inconspicuously noted in his journal simply as the slaughter of the innocents. And that act of renunciation was confirmed for him when, as a novice Jesuit, he was urged to relinquish disordered attachments that would impede his freedom and availability for a variety of ministries as well as tempt him to the sin of pride. Since then, he'd written only the slightest kinds of poetry, joshing doggerel to entertain at picnics or Latin greeting card verse for visiting dignitaries. And yet, there was always an interior and hard to quell, and yet.
So do you think that that the Jesuit order would have wanted him to renounce poetry? Was this something that he just felt obliged to do?
I think it was his own feeling, because certainly the Jesuits were writing poetry. They had a magazine that published poetry. So I think it was just the fact that he was a convert made him extra earnest and probably more constrained in his feelings about what a priest is like and what a poet is like and how they're kind of indivisible.
And why did he feel he had to renounce his poems and burn them in a secret ceremony?
I think it was in a secret ceremony just because he realized it was kind of a maudlin gesture. And we don't really know to what extent this was a complete renunciation of poetry, because there's certainly a lot of fragments and poems that exist from his Oxford days. So somebody had copies of them. I don't know who. So it seems like it was more of a gesture more than a real complete incineration of all of his work.
So, you know, there's this shipwreck that kills five nuns who were leaving Germany for the United States, where they intended to work with the poor. And he's so moved by their deaths that he decides to write a poem about it, even though he's renounced the writing of poetry. And as you mentioned, he has the sound of the wreck of the Hesperus, Longfellow's famous poem, in his head. And You say he thinks that's kind of corny. I mean, that's not the word he uses.
Exactly.
But read one verse of it for us. Give us a sense of what Hopkins didn't like.
Yeah, the Wreck of the Hesperus has a stanza that goes, "She struck where the white and fleecy waves looked soft as carded wool, but the cruel rocks, they gored her side like the horns of an angry bull. Her rattling shrouds all sheathed in ice with a mast went by the board. Like a vessel of glass, she stove and sank. Ho, ho, the breakers roared."
Right. Kind of sing-song.
Yes, it is. And I had the impression that Hopkins would have heard that ho-hoing in his mind when he was sleeping. And it was exactly the kind of prose or verse that he was trying to avoid. And he wanted to have a verse that mimicked the sound of human speech. Was really more prose-like, but actually had the same elevated language. And that's why his poetry is so difficult, because he did lots of inventions and new experiments in poetry and insisted on having real packed words, imagery that was sometimes hard to figure out at first, but was ultimately very powerful.
Let me ask you now to read a stanza of Gerard Manley Hopkins' poem about the wreck of the Deutschland, in which five nuns were killed. And we'll compare the language of Longfellow and
okay.
Hopkins.
This is stanza 17. The Deutschland has sailed from Bremen in early December, and it encounters what is called the Kentish Knock. It's an undersea island of sand that the ship founders on. And it seems as if they're going to be rescued, but the waves are too high, and then the tide rises up, and pretty soon everybody is being assaulted by these giant waves. The ship essentially becomes a reef of its own. And Hopkins picks up with that on the night of December 6th, where he writes, "They fought with God's cold, and they could not, and fell to the deck, crushed them, or water, and drowned them, or rolled with the sea romp over the wreck. Night roared with the heartbreak hearing, a heartbroke rabble, the woman's wailing, the crying of a child without check, till a lioness arose, breasting the babble, a prophetess towered in the tumult, a virginal tongue told."
Who's the prophetess?
That's the tall nun. Sister Barbara was seen to have peeked her head out through this window that was being assaulted by all this wave, and cried out, "Oh, Christ, come quickly." And there were those people who wrote about this who said that she was dejected, but the London Times wrote of it in a much more positive way, of a person seeking intercession from Jesus. And I think that's what really struck Hopkins and made him want to write the poem.
You know, Hopkins referred to his own style of writing as sprung rhythm.
Yes.
What did he mean by that, and can you hear it in what you just read?
Well, what he did was count stresses. For example, we have an iambic verse where you have a stress and an unstressed, and then we have other kinds, anapest, dactyls. But what he would do is the stressed part of a word, and he would use it with like a childhood rhyme, like "Hi, diddly-dee, the banker's life for me," where you hear the various stressed parts of each of those words and just disregard the other ones. So he invented this thing called sprung rhythm for some reason to give much more of the value and power of human speech.
So it wasn't like iambic pentameter where it would have to be accented, unaccented, accented,
right,
unaccented syllable.
Yeah, so his lines are of an even length and an even number of stresses.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
He was a fan of a lot of Greek verse, and he also learned from the Welsh, a Welsh form of chiming, they called it. And he combined his love of Greek verse with the Welsh and came up with this idea of sprung rhythm. But he didn't write real poetry for about 7 years, and during that time he was coming up with this concept of what a new kind of verse could be.
The nuns who were killed in the shipwreck on a stormy sea that Hopkins writes about, these are nuns who were leaving Germany in part to do their mission in America, but in part because the Chancellor Otto von Bismarck was cracking down on Catholics. There were crackdowns against Catholics in various parts of Europe during this time in the mid-1800s. And what was it about the story of these five nuns that moved Hopkins so much that he wanted to renounce his renunciation of poetry and actually start writing again?
Well, I think he thought of himself as an exile as well, that when he converted to Catholicism while at Oxford University, it meant that he was essentially giving up any chance of being a fellow of the college because there were rules against Roman Catholics doing that. Also, his family disapproved of his conversion, and he felt somewhat exiled from them. It's remarkable to me that his mother and father never visited him all the time that he was a Jesuit, except on his deathbed. And I think that was kind of a persistent feeling of his, that he had been ostracized by family, friends, and by his school, and knew that there was going to be certain privations he was going to have to suffer through for the rest of his life based on his religious conviction.
You know, Hopkins renounced writing, but at some point continued to write anyways. You said in an interview back in 2005 in Sojourners magazine, "I write about faith because writing for me is a form of prayer." How do you reconcile your sense, you know, of writing as a form of prayer with Hopkins' sense that the life of prayer that he had dedicated himself to was incompatible with poetry?
Well, I think Hopkins was wrong. And I think he came to realize that his poetry was a form of prayer. And certainly a lot of people use his poetry now as at least a start of their prayer and inspiration for it. You see, in the year that he is ordained, he writes some of his greatest poetry, like God's Grandeur and Pied Beauty and The Wind Hover. And each of those is a kind of a reflection of how his theological concerns ultimately get reflected in nature.
You seem to be very interested in earlier periods for nuns and priests. You know, you write about Gerard Manley Hopkins, who became a Jesuit priest. In the 1800s, your earlier novel, Marriott in Ecstasy, is about a young woman who becomes a nun in the early 1900s. What interests you about what the religious life would have been like at a much earlier time?
I think it's a little less complicated. And also, I can master a historical period to a certain extent, and everything I say will be believed, because I've done the research. Whereas if I'm talking about a contemporary period, I think people all have their own opinions about what was going on and might think I had it wrong in some way. But I think primarily, as when I was writing my books in the Old West, it seemed like the coloring was more bright. The situations were starker, so that the elemental questions rose to the surface more than they do where so much is going on in the busyness of our lives in the contemporary world.
My guest is novelist Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of the poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. You are now a deacon in the Catholic Church. You were ordained as a deacon last year. When did religion become a serious part of your life?
I think it always was. I went to parochial schools for grade school and went to a Jesuit high school and college, so I always had the very strong influence of the Jesuit priests who became my friends. And like a lot of Catholic boys, I anticipated becoming a priest at one time, and then the whole problem of celibacy dissuaded me. The idea of being a deacon didn't enter my mind until around the year 2000. And then I inquired about it and got into the program. Just simply because I became a Eucharistic minister or lector, and I found that all those ministries nourished me in some way. And I found, since becoming a deacon where I celebrate weddings and preach and so forth, that it's an exhilarating experience helping these people in the high points of their lives and to order their down points as well. It's wonderful to walk hand in hand with them and see what the Spirit is doing to them or doing through them.
In addition to writing novels about faith, you've also written about criminals. You have two books about gangs in the West, one about the Dalton gang and one about Jesse James's gang. And you wrote the book, The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, that was adapted into a movie that opened last year that starred Brad Pitt and Casey Affleck. It was a really good film. You've talked about why you're interested in writing about religion and why you are a man of faith yourself. What about Western gangs?
I think I'm really interested in outlaws and outsiders, people who are marginalized, people who look at the normal world from a vantage point that's somewhat different, who've adopted different strategies to live by. And I think that's what unites the outlaws with the nuns and whoever else I write about. And I think that in some ways that's the artist's perspective on the world. Most writers and artists I know feel like they're somehow outside the normal life and kind of are spies looking in on what other people are doing, but recognize that they don't have a quotidian life themselves. It's quite different than that. Also, as I said, I like the idea of the elemental forces at work when you're dealing with criminals, especially those of the 19th century. These outlaws who took the frontier rugged individualism to its extreme and just decided to do what was best for them and not for other people. And it's fascinating for me to see where that comes from, what kinds of worldviews these people have that allow them to take money from other people or kill other people seemingly thoughtlessly.
A lot of it has been written about Jesse James, but your novel is more about Robert Ford, who assassinated, you know, who killed Jesse James. Why did you want to write about Robert Ford more than Jesse James?
Well, it struck me as a Shakespearean tragedy on the order of Julius Caesar that a young person somehow ingratiated himself with this famous outlaw, so much so that Jesse invited him into his company and into his own home. And then Bob Ford felt compelled eventually to kill Jesse James. He had at one point made an agreement with the governor to capture Jesse James, but then the governor gave him the permission to shoot him if it was necessary, because it seemed apparent to a lot of the law officials at the time that Jesse James was riding around killing off anybody else who would possibly turn him into the government. He had become paranoid. It was kind of a rehearsal of what The Sopranos was all about, a person afraid of what is going to happen to him, so he tries to eliminate any opposition or any person who would turn him in.
From what you've read in history, how much of Ford's interest in killing Jesse James was to collect the bounty on his head, and how much was just to make a name for himself?
It was the latter. I don't think the money meant that much to him. I think Charlie Ford, who is the only one I can remember actually saying he did it for the reward money, I think that was important for him. But
Charlie Ford was Robert's brother, who was a member of the James gang.
Exactly. And both Charlie and Bob were living in the house in St. Joseph, Missouri, when Jesse was shot by Bob. I think they were both afraid that they were going to be tried and convicted of various crimes. And they were both afraid that Jesse James was so paranoid that he was going to try and kill them. And so they had extra motivation to see him done away with. And that seemed to be a kind of a cat and mouse game, almost a dance with death that Jesse was entertaining with Bob, and especially when he decided to take off his guns and present his back to Bob. And it was only time that Bob had ever seen him without a gun in his hand or nearby. And he decided to take that opportunity to kill him.
Your book about Robert Ford is in part about the nature of celebrity. Jesse James was a celebrity in his time for being an outlaw. And then Robert Ford became a celebrity for shooting Jesse James. In fact, and anyone who's seen the movie will remember this, Robert Ford, after he assassinates Jesse James, ends up reenacting the shooting on stage every night in the theater, and that's how he makes his living.
Right.
It's just kind of bizarre. Who knew something like that happened then? I mean, what year are we talking?
This was 1882, mm-hmm. and I think he did something like 800 performances in 1 year. The performance was called How I Killed Jesse James, and I don't think there's any surviving script of that, so I kind of made it up. But it was basically Charlie Ford acting as Jesse James and standing up there dusting off a picture and Bob Ford shooting him in the back. And for a while, Bob Ford was heralded as this hero. And then eventually that song that was made by Billy Gashade came around, where it talked about the dirty little coward who shot Mr. Howard. And the attention turned on Bob as a coward and a villain. And he was eventually chased off the stage and headed out west.
Was it the play itself that turned the image against him and made him seem like a coward? Because people who saw the show would see that Jesse James had turned his back to Ford, and that he'd taken off his gun, so Ford shot an unarmed man in the back.
I think that's probably it. Yeah, it's odd though, because nobody seemed to have the same feeling about Jesse James shooting somebody in the back. They treated Jesse as something of a hero, but I think, as you say, it's about celebrity, and they missed having Jesse James around, missed having the subject of these kinds of comic books. He was kind of a source of vitality for a lot of these people. The world seemed paler with him gone.
My guest is Ron Hansen. His new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins. Hansen wrote the novel The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford, which was adapted into a film last year. You know, when I was growing up in Brooklyn, I watched a lot of Westerns and movies and on TV, and for a while it was my ambition to be a cowgirl someday, which is probably the most ludicrous thing in the world that, you know, a kid in Brooklyn would be imagining. Did you grow up with a lot of Westerns?
I didn't grow up with Westerns, but I grew up with a grandfather who was alive in 1865, and He knew people who were still wearing their Civil War greatcoats, and he was out in Colorado. He had the first indoor bathroom in his house, and he had horses, and he had hired hands and all that. So I knew kind of that milieu. And where I grew in Omaha, I could drive only 10 minutes and be out in a rural area or in wilderness. We used to play as boys in an area that was reputed to be a hideout for the James gang after the Northfield, Minnesota raid. Jesse James, shortly before his death, was planning on buying a farm in Nebraska, and that was only about an hour from where I lived. So I felt I knew the area and knew what kind of people these guys were. Partly because my grandfather said he actually met the James gang at one time. And he, among all the people I've heard say that, he was the only person in the right place at the right time to have actually encountered them. But so I grew up with those legends, and it seemed very familiar to me.
What was your grandfather's memory of meeting the James gang?
He was a young man, actually probably a boy, and they had come up to the farm he was on to water their horses. And then they heard hooves off in the distance, and they immediately got on their horses and ran off. And that was the last he saw them. But he knew that they must have been desperate to run off at the sound of hooves. Nobody else would have.
You're somebody who seems to want a sense of community, the community of family, the community of the church, the community of the college where you teach, unlike the characters we've just discussed.
Yeah, I think in some ways, when you're writing, you're imagining another life. In fact, that's one of my favorite things to do still as a daydreamer, is to sit around and think of another life, what it would be like if I had been an Air Force pilot or if I was a doctor or a lawyer. I think when you're in your room writing things, you're just dreaming of another form of you, and it'll be imbued by a lot of your qualities, but it'll be a person who has challenged himself or taken risks to go in a different direction. And that's a way of exercising your imagination.
It almost sounds like you have a twin brother.
Yeah, exactly.
And I was going to ask you if you imagine a path not taken, looking at your brother's life, knowing that he's an identical twin, isn't he?
He is, yeah.
Yeah, so you have an identical twin who's headed in a different direction than you have. Right. It sounds like, you know, seeing his life is very similar to, like, imagining an alternate life.
Yeah, I remember as a really young kid standing in front of a mirror with my brother and being confused by it because I couldn't tell which reflection was which. And I think that that's probably the start of my writing career, probably, is realizing that it's a way of individuating yourself is to write, but it's also a way of becoming somebody else simultaneously.
Do you actually talk about that with each other, the kind of confusion that you had looking at each other, knowing that you looked identical but were different?
We never really talked about it. We've certainly experienced it, though, and I remember the sense of outrage I had as a young boy when people couldn't tell us apart. So it'd be like, there's John, there's Jerry, and there's the twins. So we didn't really have separate names because people would confuse us. And that was hard for me, and I think I struggled under that burden for several years. And then finally we did kind of go our separate ways, and we are not confused anymore.
Do you still look alike? Or has time changed you sufficiently?
Time changes you. He's involved in business. I'm involved in teaching, and I think that makes it you look different automatically.
Ron Hanson, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Ron Hanson's new novel, Exiles, is based on the life of the British poet and Jesuit priest Gerard Manley Hopkins.
Well, it was Robert Ford, that dirty little coward. I wonder now how he feels. Prayed at Jesse's bed, and he slept in Jesse's bed, and he laid poor Jesse in his grave. Well, Jesse had a wife to mourn for his life, three children and a baby.